You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2022 Giro d'Italia, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Today we are in Genova.
Cozze cittadine, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora. Cozze cittadine, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Carapà! Giulio Cesar! Giulio!
Fratello Carapà!
Io mi chiamo Giulio Cesar, felicità a tutto Ecuador e tutto il mondo Italia! Io 20 anni qua, già 23 anni. Niente, non sono andato, non sono andato. Niente, noi tre niente, sempre Carapà, Carapà, Carapà!
¿Quién vas a ganar el giro?
Carapaz, Carapaz.
Wow.
A lot of Ecuadorians at the finish line today, Lionel. We heard some of them there, and I didn't know that there were so many Ecuadorians in Genova. Apparently, well, there are certain areas of the city, including the area where the football club is from, where around 50% of the immigrant population is Ecuadorian. Sampdoria.
Which football club? Sampdoria or Genova?
Sampdoria.
Genoa, aren't they? They have the English name, the Genoa Football Club, because they were founded by Englishmen.
Cricketers.
That's right, yes, indeed.
But the Ecuadorians that were here at the finish line today were absolutely certain that their boy, Richard Carapaz, is going to win the Giro.
Well, yesterday, Daniel, we had a couple of gremlins in the system, didn't we, when we were recording? The third part didn't record. We had to do it again. And so, second time round, I neglected to mention that I'd asked Team Ineos why Richard Carapaz and Team Ineos had gone for that intermediate sprint to gain 3 measly seconds. But those seconds may well be critical, because this is shaping up to be perhaps a Giro d'Italia of seconds rather than minutes. It's very, very close on GC. And also, on a day like that, I think the thinking was that the riders fancied a bit of a hit out rather than just sitting in the bunch. Spin the legs a bit harder, get the heart rate pumping. That's why Carapaz saw the opportunity was there and they decided to just go for it. And that catapulted him up to second place overall yesterday, didn't
should
it?
Should we welcome another immigrant to Italy? Brian, I'm sure, I hope all of your papers are in order. I hope you're a resident, a certified resident of Italy, aren't you?
Very much so. My children were born in Italy. I live
here.
Just
checking, you just like
most
to check everyone's
time.
Credentials after Prosciuttopoli yesterday, just checking that you weren't here on business. With the race starting in Parma this morning. How are you this evening, Brian?
Very well, thank you very much.
I said the race started this evening, it started this morning in Parma, yeah. Of course.
We're sitting in Piazza Matteotti, beautiful, at least the beautiful part of Genoa. There is such
you
a thing
quite
as.
Quite harsh on Genoa when we were driving in today, and I think it looks quite splendid today, quite beautiful.
It's usually me who corrects you and trying to like make you more enthusiastic about Italy. And
Here we go.
Well, we went for a wander, didn't we, in the ancient streets there. I brought back memories of a family holiday to this area in 1990, I think it was.
You must have been posh coming to Genoa on holiday.
Yeah.
That's very recherché.
We stayed in Albenga, actually, where we're staying tonight. So I'm looking forward. That would be the first time I've been back, except for a bike ride when I did the last 100K of the Milan San Remo course once upon a time. Because it goes, basically, tomorrow's stage is kind of the reverse Milan San Remo rollout, isn't it? From San Remo.
Roughly. At least for the regions it visits.
Do you know what, chaps? I was hoping today an American would win, because this, of course, is the birthplace of Christopher Columbus. Columbus, as you would call him in English.
Did he also invent the tubing for bikes? The Columbus tubing? No.
No.
Possibly
no,
not.
No.
Did he predate that by a few centuries? I think he possibly did.
I make it the top American
Lionelpedia should be reset, I think.
And I make it that the top American today was Joe Dombrowski, friend of the podcast, 99th place. So, alas.
Well, shall we crack on with the tale of the Tapper for stage 12? This, I mean, we'll get pelters for the football reference, but this to me is...
Will Barter, 13th. Sorry, Lionel. Crack on.
This will get me pelters. But this was the calcio stage for me of the Giro, from Parma to Genoa. Parma, of course, a city with, well, a town really, with a football club. Oh, Daniel's wincing here. We're already the social media tomatoes are coming our way. But I should just mention our Kilometre Zero that was released yesterday, because we neglected to mention it yesterday. A really excellent episode on Gazzetta dello Sport, the newspaper which founded the Giro d'Italia, and there was a sort of segue into Italian football as well.
Italian football, it's mainly about cycling, it's mainly about the media, and it's mainly about the newspaper that founded, of course, the Giro d'Italia.
I mean, for me, it was absolutely perfect. It was the Venn diagram of football, cycling and newspapers, which is, that's my wheelhouse. Anyway, today was stage 12, and there was a big old break, wasn't there? I think only three teams missed it in the end, didn't they? Two probably by choice, Ineos Grenadiers, UAE Team Emirates and Groupama. Sorry, four missed it. Israel Premier Tech perhaps might have wanted to go in it, because Alessandro De Marchi tried to go across but didn't make it. There were three Alpecin Fenix riders in there, including Matthew van der Poel and old Arnie, the eventual winner, who was up the road on the stage to Etna, got it absolutely spot on today. There were also a couple of Bahrain riders in there. Crucially, there was Lorenzo Rota of Intermarché and Hees Leemreizer of Jumbo Visma, because they were the top three who contested the finish. They got away from the rest of the break, and well, it was a great finish, wasn't it, really? We were speculating who will have the fastest sprint. I personally thought Lorenzo Rota would be quickest of those three. But as they came into town, there was all sorts of shenanigans, wasn't there? Leemreizer went very, very early in the sprint. Then there was a real sort of track sprint slowdown, and they were all looking at each other and fanning across the road a bit, side by side. Leemreizer went again, but it was old Arnie, Stefano Old Arnie of Alpecin Fenix, who took the stage. And after the line, he kind of fell off his bike, you know, slumped off his bike. He didn't crash. He slumped off his bike, sat on the tarmac. The tears flowed. It was a quintessential Italian victory. Two Italian wins in a row, of course. Rota was second. Leemreizer was third. The four chasers, Bauke Mollema, Wilco Kelderman, Santiago Buitrago and Lewis Hamilton, put up a good chase but couldn't get back on terms. The bunch itself was 9 minutes down, so not much doing there. This morning, Caleb Ewan ended his Giro d'Italia. It's been a pretty torrid 10 days or so for him. It's not really worked out to plan. He was 30 minutes down, last man over the line a couple of days ago. Apparently that was all part of Lotto Soudal's plan. He would leave the Giro d'Italia at this point and will refocus on the Tour de France. But there we go, a stage win for old Arnie, and a very good one it was too. No changes to the top of the overall classification. Juan Pedro Lopez still in pink. And actually, Lopez and old Arnie are former teammates at Colmeta. They spent a couple of years together very early in their career. Wilco Kelderman, that time gain of 8 minutes has pushed him back to the fringes of the GC battle. He's up 10 places to 13th, just 2:51 behind now. And having looked completely out of it a while ago, now, well, he's maybe not made the Bora Hansgrohe tricycle, but it's certainly a tandem.
He was pretty downbeat at the finish line about his chances of having any impact on general classification, but we'll discuss that, won't we? He definitely went up in the Guillaume Martin elevator today, didn't he?
He did, didn't he? I mean, maybe not a tricycle, maybe a tandem with stabilisers, I don't know. Just before we move on, a couple of other things to mention, or one particular thing to mention. If you are a fan of our title music by Amalatera, they're having a gig in London at the Cavendish Arms in Stockwell on Saturday, this Saturday, that is 2 days' time. And several friends of the podcast will be in attendance. And I gather that because this is Amalatera's first gig since Richard Moore passed away a few weeks ago, Mark, who leads the band, is going to say a few words in tribute to Richard. And friend of the podcast, Henry Spence, says if there are any other friends of the podcast who would like to go along, do so. It's at the Cavendish Arms in Stockwell, London, on Saturday night, and all of the details are on Amalatera's Facebook page.
C'est Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success. The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens. I've been asking Christina Scrocha of the University of Verona all sorts of questions about the Super Sapiens app, what I should be looking out for. And this time I asked her what I should be learning from my first phase using the Super Sapiens sensors. How do I find out what is normal?
In this kind of first phase of using the sensor, what we normally advise to our athletes is basically to simply observe what happens and try to understand what is the impact of different factors on glucose levels. So, for instance, I wouldn't change a lot of things in the first week of using the sensor. I would simply observe what happens with different kinds of food, what happens if I mix and match macronutrients in a different way, what happens when I'm exposed to stress, what happens after a really, really hard day of training, for instance, or maybe a stressful day at work. So these are kind of all the things that we should first observe in the first week, and then, let's say, from the second week, while we're on the sensor, start actually making some changes. Where do I feel best? Where am I most stable at? And what gets me kind of out of this balance are kind of the most important things that we advise our athletes to focus on in this kind of first step of using the Super Sapiens sensor.
Just one other thing that we didn't really clarify yesterday, because I don't think any of us watched the podium presentation yesterday, did we? I certainly hot-footed it down to the team buses, but we were discussing the Cork protocol, the Prosecco protocol after the unfortunate incident with Biniam Gamai a couple of days ago. They'd already changed it yesterday. The cork was out of the bottle for the stage winner and the pink jersey yesterday, so no further mishaps.
Stefano Oldani, who we'll talk about in more detail in a few minutes, did say in his press conference that he was worried of committing an embarrassing and painful gaffe during the podium ceremony. But I guess it's a gaffe that most stage winners fear, and that's to say tripping up on the way to the podium. That's been done in the past, hasn't it? Has anyone ever gone sort of face first and caused themselves an injury? But I think everyone has that fear whenever they're going up to any kind of podium, don't they? You know, whether it's school prize giving, or I don't know if you ever won any prizes at school. Now, you were head boy, of course.
I was head boy. I mean, that possibly says more about the school than it does about me, but let's move on, shall we? No offence to the school. It was a perfectly good school.
Well, Lionel, you mentioned that it was an Italian stage win. It was also the second consecutive Italian stage win in this region, in Liguria, because the race hadn't come here. It hadn't finished here since 2015. On that occasion, it was Davide Formolo who won. Oldani also said in his press conference that he spent a lot of happy childhood holidays just down the coast at Diana Marina, which is in the direction, I think it's in the direction of where we're staying tonight, towards Albenga. And Oldani, to me, in this Giro, has looked like a guy who is on the front foot. And later in the podcast, we're going to hear from a couple of riders who have felt that they've been very much sort of behind the eight ball from the start in this Giro. And I think it's a bit of a misconception that it's a common thing to ride yourself into form in a Grand Tour. And what you tend to see is the guys who start well, they're good throughout the race. And Oldani has looked, to me, like someone who is very much in control of his form at the moment and how he's riding. Today they also got it tactically right. They learned from the mistake they'd made in Naples when Van der Poel was in a break on his own. They had three riders in the break today, and Van der Poel becomes a massive asset when he's accompanied by a teammate. When he's on his own, he almost becomes a liability.
I think in general also, when you look at that team, we've known for a while that it's not a one-trick pony operation. And I think they proved it more than once this year. But coming back to what you said about riders finding form during the race, I think a lot of that is also a mind game. Because now in modern cycling, they all have access to their data, potentially too much data. They know exactly how and when they reach peak shape. They know when they need to take it easy or rest
up.
How
well they've slept.
Exactly, all of that. so sometimes they also become too dependent on that type of information. I definitely know certain riders who have. And then eventually it becomes a mind game that they realize that once they chase those breakaways, once they sit with a winning chance, it's not so much about numbers, because they could be as good as the other four or five guys they're sitting with. They just really have to rely on their ability to race bikes more than analyze numbers.
You're absolutely right, Daniel. The numbers were significant for Alpecin Fenix, but it was significant, I thought, that Mathieu van der Poel, I think it was around about 35 kilometers from the finish, was trying to get across to the moves that were up the road. And I wondered whether, you know, old Arnie was up there as a kind of foil, or whether the initial plan was for him to go and then van der Poel to come later, perhaps when the spotlight on him was less intense and there were some other dangerous riders up the road and van der Poel could bridge across and so on. But actually, to be able to pull off a stage victory with the rider who's not the outstanding star of the team, I thought was to their very great credit. They pulled it off really well.
They're good mates, Aldani and van der Poel, and Aldani has been tantalising journalists on this Giro with what is apparently his nickname given to him by van der Poel, which is PS, but he won't explain what the PS stands for. I think it's an acronym. It sounds as though it's something scurrilous, something scandalous, possibly something linked to, I don't know, romance. Today, we went through Casanova just before the finish. Could that possibly be a clue? Aldani is also from Milan, and we went through a place called San Siro. I'm ducking as I say this. that's yellow card. We're both on a yellow card. Oh, sorry. Not a yellow card. A commissaire's warning. Commissaire's warning. Do you know what else was really interesting, though, in the press conference that Aldani gave? Was his comments about hyperbaric chambers, hypoxic chambers. Now, I had a conversation a few days ago with the drone hopper Direct Sportive Giovanni Elena, who was also bemoaning this. It's something we've known about for a long time, that Italian riders are not allowed to use hypoxic chambers, whether they're in Italy or abroad, and that practice is banned. And Aldani was quite explicit and quite clear in his press conference about the fact that, well, as he said, 90 or 95% of his teammates and other riders in the peloton, and that's also more or less the figure that Giovanni Elena quoted to me, they use hypoxic chambers. And he says, well, I have to go to altitude, spend 2 weeks away from my family, whereas everyone else is either in, for example, there's a hotel, in fact, Alpecin Fenix stayed there earlier in the year, in Denia on the Costa Blanca, and it's run by like Alexander Kolobnev, the old professional. And I'm not sure if all of the rooms or some of the rooms are equipped with hypoxic chambers, and he's not allowed to use that kind of facility.
Interesting. Brian,
I'm
actually,
sorry, but that doesn't really make sense.
What in what sense?
So they're all riding, you know, for UCI World Tour teams. They all compete in the same races. And I think if one nation, or it would probably be Kony here, that decide that there's specific rules for what Italian riders can't do, I think it becomes a little bit too unclear and also a bit stupid, to be honest. That's my personal opinion. I remember actually being in Canberra at the Australian Institute of Sport, which is a structure Australia set up and spent millions and millions just for the purpose of beating British athletes in the Olympics and the World Championships. That's basically what they told me. They had houses there that the athletes go and live in that are structured this way, so they can actually live, eat, work out and sleep, obviously, in up to 4,500-5,000 meters.
This is something that we should investigate over the next few days. Why exactly this ban has been mandated in Italy, when it dates from. We've known about it for a long time. It's certainly several years. It's not a new thing. Aldani also mentioned in his press conference that he thinks Norway is another nation that has similar regulations.
Is that because of winter sports, I guess?
Yes. And, you know, we talked a few weeks ago, didn't we, about Sonny Colombrelli, who's actually commentating on the Giro, giving sort of expert punditry, how he can't come back to competition in Italy, and if he wants to be a licensee of the Italian Federation because of his heart problem, because he can't have can't race with the defibrillator fitted, whereas in other countries it might be the same thing.
I'm going to get a yellow card now, because that's also why Christian Eriksen had
we're
to
all
leave
on yellow cards. This could be a two-man podcast football at any moment.
That's right, yeah, because of the regulations regarding his heart. It was a heart attack, wasn't it, a cardiac arrest during the Euros. I just wanted to ask you, Brian, a question, because you're almost uniquely placed to answer this one, because you've been in PR in cycling, you've been a team manager in cycling. When it comes to a team like Alpecin Phoenix, does it make any difference to them that a second rung rider on their roster has won today's stage rather than the more bankable, the superstar Matthew van der Poel? I mean, in terms of the team on the ground, they'll be just as delighted to have got a win. They'll all have a nice evening this evening. But in terms of the kind of the overall strategy of the year, delivering value for sponsors and all of that, does a van der Poel win sort of count 1.5 times an Aldani win?
No, I would almost say at this point of the team's history, potentially the opposite. They are a lot more established now than they were just a few years ago. Same way that what's now called Bo Hans Grohe, that it took a few years for them to be more than just a team where Peter Sagan raced. And I think for their internal coherence, their coaches and their sports directors, the people who do performance management there, it's a huge win for them also that they have a structure that can develop talent, that can be a good place for other riders to go and chase ambitions on their own and not just go to ride for the team where Van der Poel is. And it makes a lot of sense that a team like that will have an increased budget and will be a lot more attractive for other riders as well to follow a career path that's beyond just being in the shadow of Van der Poel.
And a second question with your PR hat on. Alpecin is obviously a caffeine shampoo, makes all sorts of claims. I mean, I obviously didn't use it enough earlier.
We're
a couple of baldies, Brian. I mean, could a bald rider ride for Alpecin? I mean,
surely happened, hasn't it?
Has it happened? That's a good question, actually.
My question would be, yes. I don't know about you, but you know, people have hair other parts of their bodies. At least some do. So maybe they can use that as a fallback.
This podcast is taking an extraordinary turn.
I tell you what, I'm going to ask the listeners to do the research for me. Has Alpecin sponsored a bald rider, either in the old Katusha days or in the current Alpecin Phoenix days? I mean, I can look this up myself.
They've got bald direct sportifs.
Well, I've given up hope, and you have probably as well, to ever be less follically challenged, if you would say, at this point of our lives. But if the stuff really works, you know, sign me up.
Shall we get back to the stage and hear from a couple of riders who were in the mix but unsuccessful? This is Wilco Kelderman.
Downbeat Wilco man.
Who was in that chase group. And also Lucas Hamilton of Bike Exchange, who was in that four-man chase group that didn't manage to get back up to the three leaders.
GC doesn't matter for me anymore. I'm just not good enough on the long climb, so I want to go for the stage win, but too many guys actually in front, and it was more tactical. We went too late. And anyway, on the climb, the front group was too strong to catch them back, so I was just riding for, I don't know, place five or something. I expected that it opened up a little bit later, and yeah. I think Alpecin and Wanty played really well. That both one guy in front, and they were with more in the front group. So yeah, it's still really far. I think you need to stand on 1 minute to be in GC. So for me, I'm just not good enough to able to fight for GC. I think Jai and Amo are in really good shape. So I think they can fight really for the podium.
Everyone wanted to get in the break. Everyone knew it was a day for the break. It was always going to be hard to control with 22 guys, and we sort of knew that maybe the opportunists would get away before that hard climb, but I sort of marked that climb as my spot where I was going to try and go, and in the end the three at the front we couldn't pull them back with four of us swapping off. I sort of played my card that climb and went over the top with Mollemar and Kelderman, and we went as hard as we could. Mollemar was going pretty fast on the descent and I was pretty uncomfortable, but in the end, the three guys at the front were just stronger and we couldn't bring it back.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp, which is a customised online therapy service which offers video, phone and even live chat sessions with a therapist, and you don't have to be on camera if you don't want to be. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. And our listeners can get 10% off the first month at betterhelp.com/cycle. Now, life can be overwhelming, and many people can get burned out without really knowing it. And that certainly was my experience of 2021. I was experiencing all sorts of things, lack of motivation, feeling sort of helpless and trapped and useless. And I had some in-person therapy, which I've had on and off over a number of years, and it definitely helps. And I try to use that as a preventative measure rather than waiting to the point where I'm starting to feel overwhelmed. And definitely talking to someone that you don't know and who is not going to be judgmental and who is not going to kind of understand intimately the kind of personal relationships you have with people, I personally find really helps. So if BetterHelp sounds like something that might make you feel less anxious in general, go to betterhelp.com/cycle.
Well, Lionel, the stage is just finished. We're having a lovely, languid afternoon walk, passeggiata through the streets of old Genoa, aren't we?
It's beautiful, isn't it? Where are we going? What are we on the hunt for this time?
I'm taking you, well, on a hunt for a Genovese speciality. I'm not sure how well known it is that this particular product is from Genova. Salve, buongiorno. Noi siamo giornalisti a seguito di Giro d'Italia e cercavamo qualcuno che ci spieghi come si fa la vera focaccia genovese. Niente, niente. Come on, Lionel, we're going to go see the oven. It's, I'm told it's very old. So, Lionel, any questions?
How old is the oven, first of all?
Yeah, they thought cent'anni.
Più o meno sì, a cent'anni questo.
Around about 100 years old the oven. Wow. E temperature 200?
Questo arriva a 210, di più non arriva.
And it goes up to...
È proprio completamente diverso.
And it's not that hot, it's not like a pizza oven. And it takes about 15 minuti, if you want
sì,
it.
Sì.
Okay. Well, let's the proof of the pudding is in the eating, Daniel. Should we break this in half?
Yeah. Notice there's no herbs on top.
No.
We've gone for the most basic, the most famous iteration of the focaccia.
€1.
Did I explain about the olive oil? Has to be from, so Ligurian oil is lighter. The further north you go, basically the lighter the olive oil in Italy. And?
Well, it's really lovely and crispy on the outside, a nice light crisp, and it's the almost honeycomb-y centre, isn't it there?
Quite salty though, isn't it?
Nice things are often salty, aren't they?
Next Odyssey, Lionel, this evening, real Genovese or certainly Ligurian pesto. Well, Lionel, did you enjoy our little jaunt through the streets of old Genova?
I did, and I love focaccia. I think it's a really, it's a lovely, it's a nice bread, Daniel.
Focaccia gets its name from the focolare, which is the hearth. And we actually saw the hearth, didn't we, the oven, at the Antico Forno Patrone, which was, well, it was ranked number 4 by a very prominent Genovese
just
food
for,
blog.
For the non-Italian speakers, that means ancient oven.
Old oven, yeah.
Okay. And I mean, it was an old oven.
It was a very old oven. And, well, the most shocking thing about the trip there to the Antico Forno was that the Genovese are commonly dunking in cappuccino. I mean, I always sort of wince slightly when we're in France and we see the French dunking their pieces of bread, butter and jam into a big milky, murky, tasteless cafe au lait. But dunking a focaccia into a cappuccino, this is apparently a very, very common thing in Genova.
But not
Ryan
the version
horrified.
Not the version with, you know, the herbs and on the
no,
top.
No, absolutely.
Surely.
Well,
really?
The natural version, the one that we had, yeah.
But it
the
would still be
version,
quite salty,
yeah,
right?
Yes.
It's very salty.
Extremely salty.
That's just wrong.
I'm going to try it tomorrow. I wonder if we'll get some focaccia.
In Albenga. I mean, the whole region of Liguria, they sort of lay claim to focaccia, but apparently it was invented here. And the word was first used in 1300, or the first record of it being used was 1300. So it's been around a long old time.
I've lived here for more than 20 years. And I learned yesterday or today that it was from Genova.
Wow.
There you go.
1,300. I mean, that's just about lunchtime.
Oh, God.
Well, we've made it down onto the Ligurian coast, Daniel, and the race will head along a bit more. Well, it'll kind of work its way back in the opposite direction as well, won't it? Because it's going up to Cuneo tomorrow and then Turin on Saturday. And that will, of course, be where I leave the Giro this year. Very sad to be in the kind of countdown. But I've got to go and prepare for the Tour de France. I'm very much the Caleb Ewan of this operation. I've had an absolute shocker for 12 days and I'm going to go home, regroup and come again for the Tour de France.
Will the rucksack of doom be making an appearance at the Tour?
My rucksack gets a hard time. I mean, it's very organised.
It's not organised at all.
It's the Bermuda Triangle of logistics.
It is. But the Grand Tours are just a continuous cycle of losing things and then finding them again and feeling that euphoric rush of having found the vital cable or wire or,
as you were sitting on it.
Or passport, which I thought I'd lost last night. But yeah, we came down through this part of the world. And just to take a more serious turn for a moment, it must have been a fairly poignant day for you, Brian, because the race went over the Passo del Bocco today. And of course, back in 2011, when you were the manager of the Leopard Trek team, there was the tragic incident where one of your riders, Wouter Weiland, the Belgian, was killed on the descent of the Passo del Bocco. And, well, you were interviewed about that for television this morning, weren't you? I mean, what was going through your mind today, knowing the Giro is going to be passing the site of that tragic accident?
I think every year during the Giro, on the day when it happened, a lot of people think about Wouter and, you know, former teammates, friends in the peloton, and, you know, the people who work with him back then are scattered on other teams, but a lot of them are still working at Trek Segafredo now. And that day was definitely the hardest day I've had ever experienced. I was relatively young as a team manager, and, you know, I had to call Wouter's father to tell him his son had died. I had to call his pregnant girlfriend, and those are things no one should ever have to do, that because it's an unbearable tragedy, and it's a tragedy that brings everything into perspective instantly. Now when I'm reminded of, you know, the sorrow has turned into memories, and memories that we try to, you know, the obligation we have, of which you all know very too well, that the obligation of trying to continue life when there's a color missing and there's a voice missing and there's something that just doesn't make sense is very, very hard. But I would say now that it's, you know, it's 11 years ago, and I try and use it as something to remind me how precious life is, and also to remind me how beautiful cycling can also be. You know, the tragedy is, there's nothing beautiful about that. That's just sad, and it's a very dangerous sport at times. But the beautiful things that happened when the sport actually is a family. And I remember I got a one-line email from Mauro Venier that day, and it just said, uno di noi, one of us, it means. And that's exactly what it is. You know, it's there's a humanity beneath all of the competition and all the envy and all the jealousy and the money and the speculation. And we're here because of that. We're here because it reminds us of very, very important things that we share, life and death and love and sorrow and joy, and all of those emotions go through everyone on a day like today. And I think there's a beauty actually of them coming back to that place, because there's an honorary element of that. You know, they also, after that, the year when Wouter died, no one can ever race with the 108 again. And all those things are just part of a beautiful element of respect and memory that I think cycling is very full of. There's nostalgia always in cycling, but it's not always just remembering that things were better in the old days. There's a beauty in that nostalgia as well, and Wouter is now part of that.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the number 108, which was Weiland's number that year in the Giro, and that number has been retired, and that is exactly why Diego Rosa of Aolo Cometa is wearing the 109 number. There's only 8-man teams, so normally they should run from 101 to 108, but Rosa wears 109. He, of course, is in the King of the Mountains jersey at the moment. A difficult day, I guess, because, yeah, like you say, it's something that certainly I've thought about recently, how the peloton carries on. I mean, I remember vividly the following day, each team took turns riding 10 kilometres on the front. I mean, it was a long day that I think the day after Weyland died in that crash. And there was this almost ritualistic, ceremonial quality to that day, a very sombre day. And I never really understood how on earth the peloton then got up the next day, the tragedy still just as fresh, but carried on and went shoulder to shoulder, elbow to elbow. And I think perhaps I got an insight into that after Richard Moore passed away, because somehow I was able to go to Scotland and ride my bike, and it wasn't normal at all, and I was I guess grieving as the peloton would have been back at that time, but I definitely understood a little bit more how the sport goes on, because it's funny, isn't it, these races, there are fatalities every so often. Fortunately, it's very infrequent, but the sport goes on, and like you say, that is what I guess everybody signs up for, isn't it, really?
I was writing about it today, and then something that, you know, often it makes things easier if you can put words to it. And there's also an element, because it's not just in cycling that people unfortunately die way too early and leave a massive gap. But I think once those memories, once that sorrow turns into a memory, I feel we have an obligation to continue, because we make a mockery of the people we leave behind if we don't continue, because the continuing actually defines the value of us being here. And I think if we all stop and immerse ourselves in sorrow, which is inevitable, but if we don't continue, we devaluate how important life is, because that's why we get sad when we miss people who aren't here anymore. So as hard as it may be, and there'll always be a gap, there will always be something missing, but we have an obligation to continue, as harsh as that may sound.
I'll just echo those very fine words from Brian, and words that we've certainly, well, had in our minds as well, or thoughts, sentiments that we've had in our minds over the last couple of weeks, Lionel. Today there was another tragedy that was being, in its own way, commemorated, and that was the collapse of the Ponte Morandi bridge going into Genova in 2018, the 14th of August 2018. A lot of people will remember the pictures that went all around the world of the middle of the bridge just basically falling out, and it was a Volvo truck that was poised just a few meters before where the bridge had fallen, and 43 people died, many more were injured, and certainly even more than that were shocked by what they'd seen. And well, the bridge was rebuilt in 2020. The famous architect Renzo Piano was entrusted with the project of designing the new bridge, which is now called the Ponte San Giorgio, the San Giorgio Viaduct. Renzo Piano, famous for his work on the Pompidou Centre, the Shard in London, and Potsdamer Platz in Berlin. It's another football reference, sorry, red card. Bari's Football Stadium for the 1990 World Cup. But, I mean, Brian, you live in Italy. You'll have followed since then the fallout, that's a poor choice of words, but that certainly the investigations, the recriminations, justified recriminations, because what was uncovered after that was a heinous story, history of negligence going back over several decades. There were some extraordinary figures quoted about the number of bridges, Italian bridges, that had been inadequately or not checked at all. There were shocking details in some of the investigations, like the one which centred on the inspectors that should have been, or should have at some point, inspected the Genova bridge and intervened shortly before it fell. They were 50 minutes after it did fall, they were texting each other about their fantasy football teams while admitting to each other that, yep, they hadn't checked it either, so it was no surprise that it had collapsed. And, you know, other interviews I read in the months that followed about the number of bridges that do actually collapse every year in Italy, about 20 a year was one estimate. It's just they're not, the consequences are certainly not as tragic and as notable as that one was.
Well, it's not just here in Genova where there are bridges, but all along this coast. We came over a number of them today, didn't we? I mean, it is a coastline of tunnels and bridges. And the one when we came off the motorway to come down into Genova itself, it really is on very narrow stilts. I mean, it's the sort of thing that if you sit and play Lego with a child, you know, it's pushing the limits, really. I mean, I'm no architect, I'm no structural engineer, but in light of the collapse of the bridge a few years ago, looking at how tall they are, looking at how slender the support structures are, they don't fill you with an awful lot of confidence.
No, I mean, I'm not a nervous person, and I get quite nervous, don't I? When we have to, well, particularly in Calabria, there are days when we're down in the south where we go over a dozen or more of those bridges as we make our way from the start to the finish.
Our very good friend Francois Tomazo, who will be covering the Tour de France with me later on this summer, he suffers from geoffrirophobia. I've probably mangled that a bit, but that is the fear of driving or crossing bridges. And there've been a couple of incidents where Francois, as we've set out for the team buses and it's required a walk across a bridge, a big long bridge, maybe with a long drop, and he's declined to go across and gone back to the press room.
Wow.
I think in general it just makes you furious that this, and this is unfortunately very typical for Italy, and you know, you often refer to it as a bel casino, like a beautiful mess, but sometimes that mess is just not very charming. And this country often, it just lets itself down, you know, and unfortunately, you know, I'm from living here, the periods where I've felt safe and felt that Italy had real momentum is often when there's a non-politician leading the country, as it is now with Draghi, who I have a lot of respect for. And it's sad that one of the reasons why he has so much integrity is because he's not a professional politician. There's a lot of things to fix in this country, and there's a lot of obvious reasons, because it is one of the most beautiful places in the world that just unfortunately lets itself down in so many ways.
I mean, football and politics, I mean, we're on the verge of a deluge of complaints. So let's leave this part there, shall we?
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Giro d'Italia is supported by Science and Sport. Science and Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. The accordion has struck up behind
us
there.
I'm waiting for Mikael Landa to turn up with his harmonica in a minute.
If you want to get 25% off all of Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and use the code SISCP25. And as we heard, their beta fuel range is not only effective but efficient. You can carry less of it with you, take less of it with you, and get a greater benefit when you are racing or training. So scienceandsport.com, SISCP25.
Lionel, there were a lot of Ecuadorians at the finish today in Genova. There were a few Eritreans at the start this morning in Parma. And, well, two of those Eritreans were riding the race, Natneil Tesfatsion for Drone Hopper and Merawi Kudus of EF Education First Easy Post. How is Kudus getting on in general classification?
He is 53rd, Daniel, 44 minutes, 37 seconds down.
And what about his compatriot, Natneil Tesfatsion?
He is 96th, 1 hour, 31 minutes and 50 seconds down.
Excellent, Lionel.
Neither of them are going to win the Giro, are they?
No.
I think we can say that. I don't speculate, but we can say that.
No, a little bird indicated to me, a little bird who may or may not have had a moustache, indicated to me yesterday that Natneil Tesfatsion may be the next big money exit. I don't know if it's big money. He may be the next high profile exit from Drone Hopper after Bernal, after
he's not known
Masnada.
For letting anyone go for free though, is he?
I don't know who you're talking about, Lionel. Brian.
I know we're both bald, Daniel.
Honestly.
It's been a long race.
Tesfatsion, I think he's been linked to Trek Segafredo in the transfer merry-go-round in the newspapers in the last few days. Anyway, Lionel, I said there were Eritreans at the start this morning. I did speak to Merawi Kudus of EF Education First Easy Post about how his Giro was going and the impact of Biniam Gamai's victory back home in Eritrea.
Hi, Merawi.
Hey.
How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Good, good. How's your Giro so far?
Yeah, the Giro so far for us quite good. Yeah, we are looking for a stage victory. Still, we are keep fighting every day.
And personally, your form, how did you feel coming into the Giro and how has it gone since the start of the race?
Yeah, exactly. My forum, I'm quite happy with the performance I have. Last week, it was a couple of stages was for breakaway. So, yeah, I try a couple to be in the right breakaway. But unfortunately, I didn't make it. My teammate make it. So, still a long way, still a lot of opportunities. So, I'm keep going.
The last time the Giro finished in Liguria, in this region, an EF, well, what the team was called then, an EF rider Formula 1, so maybe that's a good omen.
Yeah, exactly. A couple of long time ago, EF 1Z. So yeah, for us, extra motivation, you know, when you have your teammate win before, so it's extra motivation.
So the other day we saw Binyam win, obviously, and I remember seeing the pictures years ago when you went back to Eritrea and the huge parties, the huge festival. How different is the reaction now? Is it a different level, or is it very similar to what you experienced and Daniel experienced a few years ago?
I mean, you know, when you are first, always is first, you know, when we did with Daniel the first year to the France, 2015, I think this atmosphere or this situation, you know, this celebration with the president, all the ministers, all high diplomatic, everything, you know. I never seen again back, even when Ibini won Kinbergen or Wally Chamsi came second. So this kind of atmosphere, I don't know, for us, you know, Tour de France when we were first time. So it was the main key we opened the door for all of them, even for Binyam at that time was a kid. So that time, I don't know, I never seen again.
What's different about him in terms of personality, talent? What's special about him in your eyes?
Yeah, of course, it's all about talent. Talent without hard work, it doesn't work. So I think, you know, cycling is really first in Eritrea. So now the riders we have in Eritrea, all the training, it's similar with like a pro. So they know all the intervals, rest day, even nutrition, you know, all the local teams also, they have apartments and they treat as a professional. So now they changed the treatment of the riders in Eritrea. So all the riders now became more fighters and more encouraged to be a professional because they see what they're going to do in the future. They have a vision. So Binyam, one of them, you know, he works very hard.
We all know the history of Italy colonizing Eritrea. When you ride in Italy, when you race in Italy, how do you feel about Italy and Italians generally, and what would you say the typical Eritrean feeling back in Eritrea today in 2020 is towards Italy and Italians?
I mean, yeah, you're right, we colonized by Italian I think 90 is a really long time ago, so I don't remember. I know as a history, but you know, I've been long time in Europe. Most of time I spend in Italy, especially in Tuscany region, in Lucca. So I like it. I like the culture, the food, the training and everything. And as you said, we have more or less the same in Eritrea, the culture, especially the food. And there is some Eritrean as well. So I really love it, Italy in general.
E allora, signore e signori, tutti insieme, Parma, 10, 9, 8, 7... 6, 5.
E lei come si chiama?
Io Abramo Assefau.
Da quando è che in Italia? How long have you been in Italy?
Io in Italia quasi 13 anni. Io venuto da Eritrea. Io venuto per la forza, per paesani, Berbiniam, Gurmai, Mraui, Kudus, Natnel, Svacen. Per quello è venuto oggi.
4, 3, 2,
Gianni Savio over the years has been quite a talent spotter, hasn't he? I mean, he's been at it so long.
The moustached bird doesn't have a name, Lionel. he's anonymous.
No, I wasn't saying he was the source of your gossip whatsoever.
It was unrelated.
But he is the boss of Test Fashion.
Yes, he is.
Oh, goodness me. But some of the riders in the modern-day peloton who have come...
Bearded vulture or a mustachioed canary,
The Androni alumnus. Well, Egan Bernal, who you mentioned very famously, but Ivan Sosa's ridden for Fabio Fellini, Diego Rosa, Davide Ballerini, Andrea Vendrame, Fausto Masnada, Matteo Cattaneo, Simon Pello, And that's before you go back to kind of the olden days and Rujano.
Jose Rojano, yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
Johnny Trevorrow.
He's done all right, hasn't he, at spotting the talent
has.
Over
he
the
certainly
years.
He has. Lionel, we talked earlier about riders who started this Giro on the back foot and have not really been able to turn things around. There were a couple, well, there was certainly one in the break today. Matteo Sobrero, Italian time trial champion. He started very well, actually, in Hungary. He had a very good opening time trial. But since then, things have not gone too well for Bike Exchange. They've tried to regroup after Simon Yates' injury and his disappointing performance at Blockhouse. And now, well, as we saw today with Lewis Hamilton, they have started to fire riders down the road in breaks, and I guess we'll see Simon Yates trying to win a stage as well in the next few days. Matteo Sobrero is not in the best form. He admitted that himself to me after the finish today, as we're about to hear. And another rider who we talked about before the Giro, possibly not being in the best form and his preparation not having gone as well as he would have wanted, is another national champion, Norwegian national road race champion this time, Tobias Foss of Jumbo Visma.
How are you doing? How's your Giro going so far?
All in all, I think everything is good, but for sure we hope for something different, and we hoped, or I and the team also hope we could be up there in the GC, but in the end, with the preparation and stuff not going fully as planned, and this was probably the most realistic outcome, but yeah, we're still smiling and the sun is shining, so, and also every day is a new opportunity, so yeah, there's still a lot to go for.
Tell me a bit about that preparation in Tenerife. Did you feel there that it wasn't quite going the way you wanted and that it might be difficult to get to the Giro in the form you wanted? Or if you're in that position, do you still hope that a miracle might happen?
Yeah, like, for sure, I really believe in that it's not one way to get in good shape, and but after my crash in Kopje, I never really felt good, actually, so and also I got really fatigued on altitude and had to go home a bit earlier, but in the end it is like you said, and you always hope it will work out, and also, like I said, there's no right way to get in shape, so there's so many ways that can work, so of course you hope all the way until the last minute, but in the end it wasn't meant to be, but we finish this race now and then we try again.
People might say, how come you can't just ride into form at a Grand Tour? Why is it not that simple that you just, okay, your form arrives a little bit later? But what we often hear from riders is that once you're behind in your preparation, it's difficult to catch up, and a Grand Tour can actually, well, not make you worse, but well, it can make you worse.
Yeah, and for sure, I would say that my shape is actually getting better for every day here. But if you're not at 100% from the beginning, then you have days like I had on Blockhouse where you're just completely empty and loses, like you have no power and you lose a lot of minutes. So I think you just have to be really prepared from the beginning. And in my head, yeah, you maybe don't have to need the real high power or something, but you need to be able to recover every day. And my shape is not good enough for that at the moment to go full out every day. So it is how it is. It's getting better, and it's still a lot of stages to smile for.
So it sounds like you're going to be picking your days in the last week. Is today one of those days, maybe?
Yeah, today is one of those days for sure. And I think now all the way until stage 18, I will really chase a one day result, and then from 18, I think I will put the brake on a bit and really save up as much for the time trial as possible, and then and really really go hard on the time trial.
And last thing, Tobias, this is your second Giro now, isn't it? Have you seen anything on the Giro?
One more, I guess.
Have you seen anything on the Giro this year, or have you seen a place that you didn't know that you've particularly kind of fallen in love with and wanted to go back to?
I think for sure the whole Italy is just so nice, and my sister is actually moving to Firenze now in the autumn, and I will for sure visit her a lot and spend some time here riding my bike. It's such a beautiful country, and all the culture is also super nice.
Well, Matteo, you managed to get into the break today, and well, how did you feel out there, first of all?
I'm not feeling so good. I spend a lot of energy to get in the break, and then I want to go in the break also to test myself and to see how is my shape, but it's not so good, so I don't know, yeah. We take day by day, and I hope in the third week to find some good feeling.
You seem a little disappointed.
Yeah, yeah. With the team, we work hard for the Giro, and so I'm a bit disappointed because, yeah, I'm struggling to find a good feeling, yeah.
And Matteo, if it's not going to be you over the next 2 days, I mean, you know these stages perfectly in Piemonte.
Yeah.
What do you think we're going to see? Do you think we're going to see any general classification changes?
Yeah, that's one of the points why I'm a bit disappointed, because we passed close to my home, and I want to do well, no, on my home soil. And I think tomorrow is not a problem, but the stage of Turin will be really hard.
Grazie. Domani si beve il dolcetto.
Well, chaps, that was Tobias Foss and Matteo Sobrero talking about his home stages coming, the Piedmontese stages, two of them coming the next couple of days. Of course, Matteo Sobrero, he comes from a winemaking family, Brian. His dad, Giorgio Sobrero, makes a nice dolcetto. And a nice Nebbiolo as well up there in Montelupo Albese. But yesterday was the food stage, not the wine stage, although we turned it into a bit of a wine stage as well.
Can we just agree that any stage in the Giro, yes, is a food stage?
They're all food,
exactly,
and wine stages.
Exactly.
And Bella Vita, Dolce Vita stages. What did we have? What did we enjoy last night? We had guinea fowl. You boys had guinea fowl, didn't you?
No, I had rabbit, actually. The first time I've had any meat for a while, other than a kind of ragu-type meat. It was very, very nice indeed. Before that, had some ravioli with...
Tortelli. Pumpkin, weren't they?
Pumpkin and verde. What was the verde? It must have been spinach.
It was spinach. Yeah.
And before that, we had a sort of parmesan...
Gnocco fritto we had.
Which was, those little puffy pillows. Lovely. I really like those. Pleasant to eat. Very pleasant to eat.
And actually quite delightful Lambrusco. This is very underestimated wine.
Was it a Lambrusco?
I think so.
It was definitely a Sangiovese from... No, it wasn't a Lambrusco. It was a Sangiovese. It was from near where we were staying, in Borzano, I believe.
I think
we can all agree the headquarter of Lambrusco.
It was nice.
I made the mistake of ordering a Tuscan wine initially.
I know, I wasn't too enamoured with that, was I?
It's going to be fish tonight. Daniel, you're not a big fan of fish, are you?
No, so what are you doing tonight, Daniel?
But when we go into the Piedmont region, I've never had bagna cauda, but I've been told it's not your thing.
Well, it's not really for this time of year, necessarily, I would say. Ravioli del Plin is a common dish to have in Piedmont. Lionel, we're talking a lot about food. I'm getting hungry. We've always talked a lot about food in the podcast, particularly in 2019 when we started in a city famous for its food, so much so that it's nicknamed La Grassa, the fat one, Bologna. Very fond memories of that weekend. We were with our great friend and comrade Richard Moore, and well, there was a lot of talk that weekend about spaghetti bolognese, tagliatelle. Here we are in Bologna in 2019.
Il Giro del Bufalo, remembering Richard Moore.
Hi, Giro d'Italia. What it means for you? You are English.
Scottish.
Are you Scottish?
Oh, very important. Very important distinction.
The Bologna is one of the greatest city. She get all people all the time. It's by to the university, at the university. It's nothing. It's the people they live in.
Well, that wasn't Marlon Brando. Daniel, who was that?
Well, it was our host last night, wasn't it? The restaurateur, I think the owner of La Drogheria de la Rosa. Very appropriate of the chemist of the rose or of the pink. Probably actually slightly inappropriate vis-a-vis the Giro d'Italia. And Giro d'Italia.
You said earlier the Bologna is known as the fat one, also the red one and the learned one. It's got these three names, isn't it, for its history of its university and its politics.
very much so. Very much so, Rich. We will obviously be focusing on the food because we're neither learned. Well, red, well, maybe. we ate very well, didn't we, Napalm? We had a couple. We've already had a few specialities.
I was stunned to arrive in Bologna and you revealed that the mayor of Bologna is trying to outlaw.
I've been having correspondence
bolognese.
With him.
Have you been in touch with him?
I've been having correspondence with him. I think I might speak to him tomorrow about his campaign to rid the world of spaghetti alla bolognese. It's a long old story. This, I don't think you want me to go into it. There's a big battle going on between Bologna and Napoli. Napoli says that it should be spaghetti alla bolognese. In Bologna they say spaghetti have never existed. In Bologna they're vermicelli, which are little worms, but they would never have them with ragu, with bolognese sauce anyway.
Is this going to appear in episode 1 of Kilometre Zero on Monday?
I think it will be mentioned.
Excellent.
Kilometre Zero, well, nice mention, Lionel. Kilometre Zero sponsored by Hans Brohr.
Well, Daniel, we need to get to Albenga. I booked us onto the campsite that me and my family stayed in 1990. I can probably picture where it was. We can get there. I know you're the sort of person that would love camping, Daniel, I'm sure.
Don't try to turn the listeners against me.
Any campers out there that will turn on Daniel, because you did say camping's not your cup of tea.
No, I'm a very laid-back character and everything just tends to wash over me. I'm very sanguine about most things, Lionel.
I thought with your I mean, Brian,
you're talking about someone else right now. Clearly.
But with your love of the outdoors, I would have thought camping would be that right up your street, but no.
My idea of outdoor living is sort of setting off with a saber, as discussed yesterday, and just surviving off the land in the wilderness for, you know, a couple of months, not with a tent that I bought from Decathlon.
Well, anyway, we're off to Albenga and we're hopefully going to be meeting up with Stacey Snyder, who's come over from the US to visit the Giro d'Italia. Looking forward to hearing about how her time here has been, and she has got a huge consignment of her cups which we've got to distribute over the next couple of days. Oh, don't worry, Daniel, I'll do that. There's for people in the peloton, I think something for you maybe even as well, Daniel. But it would be great to see Stacey, and I think we'll probably record a bit with her for the podcast, because the collaboration with Stacey Snyder and her cups stretches back a number of years now and really stemmed from Joe Dombrowski's diary at the Giro d'Italia in, I think, 2015. I could be getting that wrong. It would have been 2015, I think. He kept an audio diary for us, and Stacey decided that Joe Dombrowski was cup-worthy and contacted Richard to find out how she could send a cup to Dombrowski. And that's how this whole collaboration kicked off. So it will be great to see Stacey a bit later. We'll all be enjoying some fish, and Daniel will be sat there with an empty plate.
I know. Kilometre Zero tomorrow. Well, there's already one out that was, you mentioned it earlier, La Rosea, the pinky, about La Gazzetta dello Sport. Tomorrow there's one, it's going to be called, I think we're going to call it Popo the Good Fight, or Popo's Good Fight, something like that. Might change between now and when it comes out tomorrow morning, but it will come out tomorrow morning.
But it features Yaroslav Popovich, who is Ukrainian.
He is. We'll say no more.
Until
Except
tomorrow.
Buonasera.
Daniel, thank you. Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.